All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Reach the Stars podcast. Today, our guest is Amity Catherine Libby. She is a paper flower artist and an educator and a writer from up in Maine. And she makes amazingly realistic things out of paper, and you'll have to go and check them out. So we're going to have an interesting, fun conversation with her and her beautiful daughter. Because that is real life as a mompreneur. That is real life. Like, your kids are just climbing on you while you're trying to make things, and that's just how it goes. So, do you want to give a little bit more about your background and what where you come from?
Well, I am originally from Massachusetts, and I moved to Maine as a little kid when I was 9. And this is my little Maine girl. She was born here in Western Maine 4 years ago. She's full of it. My husband and I were both teachers in this region for many years, and that's how we met. We're no longer teachers in the public school system. Zoe, it's mom's turn. Can I take my turn, please?
I wanted to take my turn.
Right. What do you want to say about us? What do you want to tell them? What do you want to tell John? Thank you. I do have an art degree in my undergrad, but mostly I've been teaching for most of my career. My last position was working for a botanical garden developing curriculum for middle school kids. And it was statewide, and we did it all online, but I ended up visiting everybody's school. Then I had Zoe, and I started with the paper flowers thanks to the Instagram community. I fell in love with the visual. Mm-hmm. And then I realized the cost to begin was so low.
Yeah.
I could. And so that's how I started with paper flowers.
Awesome.
So, yeah, just a little bit about me.
So as far as your paper flowers, your main jam doing them as far as income is doing workshops, correct?
Yeah. So actually my main source of income are my video courses. I take how to make a flower and I break it down into steps and I record myself, actually just my hands. People usually don't see my face ever because I'm too lazy to put it on. sometimes I don't even wash my hands. Like I'm like, I've been in the garden. My hands are filthy. But yeah, I make short video courses. Zoe, how about at the end you can sing? Would you like to sing at the very end? It's mom's turn.
I want my turn back.
You do. Choppy and four. Anyway, at the beginning, she slept a lot, or I would have childcare, or my husband would watch her. And now I 1,000% pay for childcare to record. All right. You're my little imp. So it's been great. I use a platform called Teachable, but since I was a classroom teacher for my career, I found that part really simple, like setting up a lesson with an outcome, a beginning, middle, and end, skills. Like this was all part of my practice.
Yeah.
So it was a really good segue into teaching adults to do something that wasn't based on test scores. So the stakes are so low. It's such a stress-free environment for me as a teacher. I love it.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's one thing that the pandemic, I do miss teaching people because I did a lot of in-person workshops because I live in a city. So, you're pretty far from a metropolis. So I know that, you know, Buffalo, where I am in New York, is not the hugest city, but there are, you know, a fair amount of people. And we have a pretty vibrant book arts community here with a great book arts center. And they do all sorts of workshops. So I typically was teaching my workshops through them.
My focus in my undergrad was the book arts. We have Bernie Vinsani as the faculty that started our book arts center.
Awesome.
I'm gonna keep rubbing your back. Sit on my lap. Yeah, there you go. Bernie taught paper making, had a Vandercook press in his house, you know, worked for the Smithsonian doing book restoration. And I was in a town of like my university had 1,000 kids. Mm-hmm. Right. And we had access to this amazing guy who has since renovated my dorm basement into a book arts factory. I mean, it's amazing.
Awesome.
So I recommend anyone who's interested in paper at all, look up book arts places, because that's where you'll find, like, it's happening.
Yeah,
like,
you'll find your people. Your people are there. They're making cool things. Exactly. Yeah, my undergrad, I went to Warren Wilson. That was outside of Asheville in North Carolina. And my main teacher there for book arts classes was Gwen Dean, and she was amazing. I mean, she just does so many things. She was teaching like drawing and illustration and printmaking and papermaking and bookbinding and all this stuff. And they had like a whole papermaking studio. They had a Hollander beater and all the stuff. And it was just amazing to be able to have all of that at my tiny college, like similar to yours. Like, we had 800 students and 1,100 acres of land. It was amazing. Like,
And the thing that is amazing to me too is when I dye my paper, I am immediately transported back to making paper and dyeing it myself when I was 20 years old. And I'm 43. Yes. So it's like, I'm still talking,
okay? I want to still talk too.
No, it's not your turn. It's mom.
It's my turn.
I think you think it's your turn. You're a biscuit. How on earth can it be your turn?
Because it's my turn.
Okay, let me finish what I was saying. So the joy I felt at that time, as you know, you get older and you get a little jaded, right? And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, it's the magic. Right? So that's why we do it. It's like, it's magical. It feels so good to transform something so basic into something so, you know, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's my favorite thing about working with paper is that it's so versatile. There's so many things you can do with it. And I don't know, I have this quote on my website that as when I'm talking about paper, that there's just something about handling paper in general that like sends me to the moon and brings me back to earth at the same time. And it's like, it gives me that space to like be in limbo where like there's like magical things that are like coming and going simultaneously. I'm all about it. And it was a feeling for me when I first got my papermaking set up, because I hadn't worked with a Hollander beater since I was in college. And I ended up finding somebody selling their whole entire studio on Instagram in the middle of the night when I was up nursing my baby and trying not to fall asleep scrolling on Instagram. And I immediately emailed them. It's like, oh my God, what have you got? I want all of it. And I ended up buying every single thing that they had and my husband traveled to Indiana, rented a truck, loaded it all up and drove it all back here and set it all up. And as soon as he got it ready, I was like, take this baby, I'm making paper. And
I remember finding on like before Craigslist, we had like Uncle Henry's. People would be like, I have this old printing press in my garage and I can't move, come get it. And we would, you know, these little, we ended up with two Kelsey Excelsior presses, which no longer, I mean, those things weigh so much.
Yeah.
Anytime I see presses online or people doing paper book, you know, printing, I get so excited. Can you bring this down to the floor, please, and have all of them? They all need you to sing. All of them. But which one is going to be the baby? Who's the daddy?
I don't want the daddy.
Who's this one?
I want this one.
Do it.
So cute. Good
job. I go put them to bed. They must be sleepy. I just want to say the name of my college. It's the University of Maine at Machias. You know, it's small, but it's on the coast of Maine, which is a mecca for artists. So you can get a really valuable education by osmosis for pretty cheap. You just have to be willing to live in a really small, isolated, beautiful, stunningly gorgeous place.
Yeah, it's really similar to how Warren Wilson was, because it's like way, way up in the mountains and it's like this little It was like a hippie commune in the middle of the Bible Belt. Like, it was so weird. I mean, we were like 3 miles from the Billy Graham Training Center. And then, like, we would go to school in this place where, like, the teachers would teach with no shoes on. And like, you'd go call them all by their first name and then go hang out at their house after class and drink tea and, like, talk about politics and philosophy and stuff. And
I'm not sure everyone has a chance to, like, access that type of education if you go to a really big school. And so that was one of the things that kind of blew my mind when my book arts teacher was like, we're going to go print at my house because that's where the press is, and I'll feed you. And the class moved, you know, we went to his house and he fed us while we kept earning credit, you know?
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, this is amazing. So plug in for small institutions.
Yeah, small liberal arts is where it's at, unless you want to be totally anonymous, you know? Like, if there's people who, like, you know, really hate when everybody knows your business, that's probably not your place.
For you.
Yeah, I mean, the school that I went to, it was like summer camp with classes. Like, it was so much fun. Every minute of it was so much fun. It's the second I stepped foot on the campus. I went there and I had wanted to be a writer. I wasn't even really doing a lot of visual art when I went there. And I've been writing poetry my whole life. And I set foot on the campus and there was like this vibe. And I was like, I just have to make stuff like right now. I just have to. And I ended up.
I started off as a creative writing major too. And then I switched when they were like, we have this brand new degree. It's called Interdisciplinary Fine Arts.
That's so fun.
Not enough classes to make it a specialty yet. Just take everything we offer. And I did.
So I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about kind of navigating having these like different aspects of your creative life, like being, you know, being an educator and being a writer and being a paper artist and like trying to, I don't know, want to do all the things, but having to kind of like focus on one thing at a time. And I'm curious how you navigate that in your life.
I would say it's a difficult challenge, but I do vacillate towards things that pay me. Because time is money now. Now that I pay for childcare, I understand more than ever before how valuable my expertise can be to a certain population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was teaching, I was an ENFP, which means I'm really empathetic and pushing people to find their gifts. And as I moved away from public education, I started testing as an ENTJ, which is the boss, leader, and very bottom line oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So I make most of my decisions on how I create, on what will pay me, which sounds so terrible on the one hand. On the other hand, it buys me my freedom.
True.
For example, last year I worked in Europe for a month. I stayed with family. I didn't have to pay for that housing or food like you'd have to on vacation. But I definitely worked every day and I definitely loved every second of that freedom. So as I gained my confidence with asking people to pay for my expertise,
mm-hmm.
I'm able to tap into other areas that they are interested in, like writing. It's like, oh, now that you know that I'm this person that's creative, I actually have this whole other life that I've led my whole life. Do you want to read my poems? Like, right? So I think as a creative person, you definitely want to do all the things. And as an adult, you have to adult. And I think there's this myth too, that artists are kind of all over the place. And that's so not the case with me. I have a laser sharp focus on, if I put in X amount of hours, I will get a result that works for my lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the sum of it. I'm really interested in making money to invest for my future. I've found a way that people want to work with me and pay for that, which is thrilling, an honor, and something I take super seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as much as anything else that I take super seriously, I take my relationships with my fellow artists really seriously. I can't believe Paper Flowers is the space that I have evolved into. Like, you couldn't have told me in college when I got my diploma, someday someone's going to pay you to do this. It's like, no, no. Are you high? no. And now I'm like, no, this is what they taught us to do. This is what they taught me to do. It's not reaching for this thing that's out of reach. Mm-hmm. It's building a foundation from the ground up over time. Yeah. And at the end, we have a beautiful environment where people feel welcome. So, and I think that's the last thing I can say about deciding where to put my time. It's never a get rich quick or instant domination of a field for me, ever. It's always like, oh my gosh, this is interesting. I think I'll spend the rest of my life learning about it over time.
Yeah.
And that's a freedom that I possess because I went to a small liberal arts school that says, I'm teaching you how to think, not how to be.
Yeah.
You gotta be later. You have to become later. Becoming is the process.
Yeah. So it's funny because when you were like, when you told me when I graduated, I'd be doing this, that's crazy. It's funny because my major at school was also like an integrative studies, but I made up my own major and I actually did entrepreneurial business and creative art together with a focus on book arts. So I got the whole like business foundation and integrated like how to make money with art, and that I've been working my way toward doing this since I was 19. I mean, I even have the same name for the business and everything. Right. It's where the name of the podcast came from too, because I had, I still have my business plan from college, like right next to my desk.
And I think when you write your shit down, you take your shit seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Art is something to be taken seriously. It's political. It changes people's perspectives. It makes you think twice if it's really good. You don't even have to agree with it. Right? It is transformative to both the artist and the artee, right? Mm-hmm. The one who received it or views it. And so it behooves us to say, yes, take it seriously.
Yes.
The means within you is so fucking worth it.
Yes, exactly. And there's so much power in the flexibility of book arts to be more than a poem or more than a painting, you know, because it's so experiential. It's how it feels. It's how it sounds. It how it, you know, it's everything all round into one, and you have to interact with it in a way that most visual art isn't. And I think that's my favorite thing about it. As soon as I learned about artist books and that they were a thing, that you could have the form and the design and the words and the images and the materials all work together to make this like bigger concept, I was like, that's my jam. Like, I want to do that. So,
and I'm pushing the envelope with paper flowers because I want people to see it as like an artist book. It's not just a peony. Like, how can I tell a story with it? Mm-hmm. And I'm totally there. But that's my goal, is to be a visual storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to make like 5 billion flowers before I can like lay it down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, I've taken some of your courses and I love the style that you work with. And you just kind of say, you know, you're kind of like the Bob Ross of paper flower making, you know what I mean? You're just like, yeah, if that one falls off, just glue it back on later. It's okay. Like, you know, because the paper flowers typically look more real if you don't make them all exactly the same way. And if they're just like, that one's pinched a little bit different over here or whatever, like they look more like real flowers because real flowers don't all look the same.
The environmental factor is what I always factor in, both real and paper. I'm the environment when it's paper and I will screw it up. Like if there's bugs in my dahlia, that's going to screw up my outside flowers. So I think it does look more real for sure.
Yeah.
Embracing it. Like, now the environment is totally impacting this. Oopsie.
So I also wanted to ask a little more about navigating running your own business as a mompreneur and like the way that the world is set up right now, which is unfortunate, is that, you know, if men go to work, they're not made to feel guilty for taking time away from their kids and their family because that's what's expected. And that there's all of these pressures on moms to, you know, if you're a stay-at-home mom and you don't work, then you're lazy and you don't contribute to your family. And if you go to work, then you're neglecting your kids. And like, how do you kind of navigate being in the middle of all that?
Yeah, I definitely have pushed myself into what I consider to be the best of both worlds. I did start back in a K-12 position after my child was born, and I did enroll her in daycare, which was good for us simply because of our location. Like, I have no neighbors. Like, I can't even see a house from where I live. So she has to see other children, right? She just turned 4, so school will happen for her eventually, and she'll get it that way. But so in the beginning, I thought to myself, this is great because my child needs this, and the stability of this paycheck is what makes me feel good. Then the shit hit the fan with the Kavanaugh hearings, and I just had a mental breakdown where I went into the woods for 3 weeks, took time off from my K-12 job. And at the end of it, I came out and I told my superintendent, "This system is broken. I have some ideas on how we can fix it. You may take me or leave me." And she said, "I think we should leave you." I said, "Okay, love you, bye." And that was the point where the dam broke in my life, where I said, it does not matter anymore. I have to stand up for what I believe in. Because mm-hmm. my daughter is watching me. And I think that's one of the most empowering things mompreneurs can have, is their child watching them. Mm-hmm. So again, that's my inner compass. I have to make decisions based on what's good for my kid. That is not always a popular decision, even within the dynamic of my marriage. Mm-hmm. But again, I have to keep showing up and say, I have to be calm and I have to be clear and I have to state what I need and how you can help. And if you can't help, I'm happy to do it myself. Right?
Yeah.
For my husband, that has been a very direct conversation about, if I put 20 hours a week in, I will get X amount of dollars out and I can pay for this thing that we have decided is important for our lifestyle. Mm-hmm. That's taken years to have that conversation without a little bit of, but I'm busy. It's like, no, dude, I know you're busy. I would like to be a little busy too.
Yeah, seriously.
Seriously. And so he has come to this place, and he's a pretty, you know, woke man. He's got 2 younger sisters. He's been through a lot of, you know, male, female relationship stuff because he lived with 2 girls, mm-hmm. right? And it's, again, coming back to him and saying, I just need this, and I don't have to justify it to you right now, but I do need to ask you for help to get it done. Mm-hmm. And then we can come back to it and process it. And I do get the time that I need, which has been amazing. Having said that, I am not the primary breadwinner in my family.
Yeah, me neither.
I take a lot of time to express my gratitude that because of his support, I get to do and say a lot of stuff that, if people don't like it and they want to leave, okay. Your economic support doesn't affect my bottom line because my guy's out there hustling. And yeah. So it's a give and take in our relationship. He understands when I put the time in, I get the money out, which helps our big picture of success.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of other things, like I would say my peer group, my friend group, while they love and support me, it's like those memes where it's like, what my mom thinks I do, what my friends think I do, what society thinks I do, what I actually do. You know, I cannot paint the picture for them. They already know me as I am. Mm-hmm. It's the people on the outside are like, oh, your life is so amazing and beautiful. And, you know, it's like,
and you're like, it's so hard. I'm so tired.
It's laundry and dishes. And my husband asking, why is the house not clean? And me going, because I was busy, right? Like,
yeah.
And it's just a constant conversation, honestly.
Yeah. I have a hard time navigating that sometimes because he's very creative too, and he works his full-time jobby job, and it's a little bit creative. He's a carpenter, so he gets to actually like build things with his hands, and he's active all day long, but he works for somebody else, so he doesn't get to make any of the plans, and it's definitely not what he wants to be doing with his life. So our kind of 5-year plan, which is turning into more of a 10-year plan, is that I've actually not been paying myself hardly anything at all and just investing all the profits back into my business so that I can scale it more. Within a couple of years from now, like when both our kids are in school full time, if there is full time school, please let there be full time school. then that I'll be able to pay myself a salary that will replace his salary so he can quit and he can do right. his creative stuff too. And, you know, it's,
as I think that's really, I applaud that method. I think anyone who is in our position where we're not, we're the secondary people and we have an income, you know, I had my net profits last year were $11,000. Okay. And I did not pay myself $11,000. That $11,000 was on the roof and in the basement and in the ground. And like, it's invested in our lifestyle and my business.
Yeah.
$11,000 is a lot of money to have to invest in yourself, right? And I didn't make that type of money until I made that decision to like scale. Like you said, scaling mm-hmm. costs money. You have to invest.
Yeah, you have to spend money to make money. And it's right. definitely one of the things that he, as someone who currently is not a small business owner and yeah. like hasn't had his, he's had his own kind of like smaller business, but really it was like just him doing his thing and he never had like staff or anything like that. And when you're, because right. primarily I don't teach as my main source of income, like we actually make product. So there's only so much making of product and scaling a business that one person can do by themselves. Like I need staff. There's no way that I could put in more hours and like get more out by myself. So right. he's very hesitant to like say, when is it worth it? Because I'm not typically like shoveling money into the bank account. I'm putting money in the business bank account and like buying new equipment and paying staff and like working with marketing people and like doing all that kind of foundation and doing coaching. Yeah. And like, he's just very much of a kind of, you know, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it all by myself kind of person. And that definitely yeah. has been kind of tough to navigate between the two of us. And when I quit my full-time job, our first was like,
picture is what they need. Like when I tell them this is the foundation and at some point we're going to be on the deck, like enjoying it. Or when I say things like, if I put in 6 hours on Saturday recording and I sell 10 classes, that's a profit of X. Like very linear logical when I talk to him about very cause and effect.
Yeah. It's definitely been a tricky thing to navigate. When I first quit my job to stay home with our first son,
because yes.
The job that I was working, I was editing photos for a jewelry company, and it was a, you know, decent yes. job for an artist. It was somewhat creative, but not in a way that it like sapped my creative energy, because it was just me photoshopping all day long and listening
right. to yeah. podcasts. Like, you know, I can deal with it. I know how to do it.
You know, it's like I had a comfy chair, I had paid vacation, health insurance, you know, it was like decent day job, but I wasn't making enough that if I was paying full time for daycare, I would come home with no money.
Right.
Be like right. healthcare, daycare, and someone else is raising my kid. And if it's not putting any money in your bank account and you're just working for that, like it's not worth it. So we decided that, that I was going to quit working there. And our first conversation that I had, I was like,
it was like, for the money I make for what I do, like, once you don't care about that part, because you're like, no, I can make more on my by myself.
Yeah.
Then it becomes the fight of, so how do I get the time at home?
Yeah, exactly. And I was just like, we definitely had the conversation that I was saying, you know, are you sure that you're not going to resent me for not having a paycheck for quite a long time? Like, right. Where, I mean, it's going to look like I'm putting in a ton of effort for a long, long time and not getting a lot of tangible outcome right away. Yeah, and it's right. like, well, if you made more money at your job than I do, then I would stay home, but you don't. It doesn't make sense. So just do your, right. stay home and do your book thing. And it's been weird for me because, I mean, my mom always worked. My mom worked 5 part-time jobs. And yeah. still had less than 40 hours a week, but she was out of the house for like 60, 75 hours a week because it was 5 jobs in the same building. And it'd be like 3 hours at that job and then 2 hours in between and 3 hours at that job. So she's there for like 14 hours and gets like 6 hours worth of work because it didn't make sense to like drive home in between. And so I grew up with like all of my, I had a lot of parents. Both my parents were married to other people when I was born.
Okay. I was wondering about that when I saw your posts.
Yeah, my family's a little weird. And I'm very blessed to have had all of these different parents in my life and different aspects of my family. I was with my mom from Monday to Friday, and then Friday night and Saturday night, I was with my one dad, and Saturday night and Sunday, I was with my other dad, and then I'd go back to my mom's house. So I got to see like the life of being a kid that lives with a broke single mom most of the time, and like that she wasn't there a lot because she was working, and my brother and I were home alone, and we were, you know, 8 and 5 and we were alone. And that's just not okay now, apparently, but like that's the world I grew up in. And then I'd go on the weekends to my dad's house.
Acknowledge that, right? Like we have parents who hustled so hard, and you still can grow up impoverished.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How do you break that cycle?
Exactly. And
that's the question of the hour. That's why I go to work every day. I'm sure that's why you go to work every day. I do think I want my kid to go to work every day, but I don't want her to feel ever that she's insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had to work 60 hours at 5 jobs, which I could very well be your mom.
Exactly. Doing that right now. Yeah. And my husband's family, I mean, his parents were just barely out of high school when they had his older brother. And by the time he was born, his parents were like 20 and 21 and had 2 kids. And his mom was a stay-at-home mom until his youngest brother, he's got 4 other siblings. So there's 5 kids. And she was a stay-at-home mom until his youngest brother was just about done with high school before she even had a job doing anything in her life. And so he grew up with this, like, this kind of, you know, stereotypical family where like the dad is working all the time and the mom is always there and the mom does everything and she's super involved. And I grew up pretty much like I knew how to make myself macaroni and cheese when I was 6, you know, and like he just didn't have that as his family structure. So when he's like, oh, just stay home and do your book thing, I was like, oh, awesome. I finally get a chance to like do the thing that I've been dreaming of doing since I was 19. I want to be doing this full time forever. And now I actually get a chance to do that. And he, in his mind, was like, oh, you're going to like keep doing the occasional craft show and making some stuff. And mostly you'll just be like doing what my mom did. And like, we like did not have the right conversation when that started. And it has caused some friction, but I mean, we're at the point now where like I'm working in a 2,000-square-foot studio. So like something is working, you know what I mean? It's not off or not, but it is hard to like match up with the expectation.
We talk a lot in our relationship about the dynamics we grew up with in our family. Zoe, I need you to let mommy have her turn.
I can hear my kids. I hear them. They're coming down the stairs.
We're both one of six. We're both from blended families. That's what it's like.
Yeah, that's sort of what it's like. You're like, oh, I'm doing something. And they're like, no. Yeah, it was a total game changer when I got to move my office downstairs in the building that we own. Because it used to be in one of the bedrooms we had upstairs. And there are no boundaries. I was like, I am in here working. And they're like, where do you want stuff? And, you know, there's always like Cheerios ground into the carpet. And I was like, I can't focus in here. And when I got to move down here, it just seems... I go down into my office. It's on a different level. It's in a different space. Like it feels so much more like going to work than like leaving my family. You know what I mean? Like and ignoring the family. It's different for me.
I don't have that yet. I'm jealous. I will say, I rented a space one for a summer and it was great, but I hated driving anyplace. I would love to build a small studio on our land here because we have the space. But we're just not ready to take that sort of, I'm not saving actively for that yet. We have other stuff to do first.
Yeah, it's weird. Cause when I was in college, I remember I had this like someday dream that I was like, someday I'll have this really awesome like studio space where I can make stuff and I'll have a place to make paper and I can hang out with my artsy friends and do like read poetry and like have this cool space and I'll live above it with my family. Wouldn't that be awesome? And when my husband and I got together, we started looking at properties, and we play music together. So we needed like a space where we could be loud and not bother anybody. We wanted a cool place to live, and we needed a space that I didn't even have paper making equipment, but it was always on the back burner. Like someday if we're going to buy a place, it needs to have a space for that, cause that's what I want to be doing. And so it had to have like somewhere I could get the floor wet that wasn't like 4 feet tall.
Right.
And he's an oil painter too. So he's like, I need a place where I can have a studio and have his carpentry shop. And if we could have tenants and get rental income, that'd be great too. So it took a long time to find a space that had all of that in it. And as soon as we saw this building come up, I was like, babe, this is the spot. This is the building. It's got everything that we need. And he's like, stop trying to look at it. Don't even look at it. It's out of our price range. We can't afford it. Don't do it. And then they ended up lowering the price. And I was like, let's just go look at it. Like, I mean, it's still too expensive, but let's just go look at it. And we came here and we walked up the stairs. We got to the top of the stairs and I looked at him and I was like, I don't care if we never eat again. We need to make this happen. And at the time, it took us almost 5 years after owning the building to be able to have my office move downstairs. Where we had saved up enough from having the tenant in the front space. And we got a grant to do a bunch of work on the building through the Main Street grants.
Thanks
a lot for that. And we got to, there, the storefront space that I'm in now actually was one big, huge storefront space. And we used some of the grant money to put up a wall and make two storefront spaces. So we still have a rentable space. And then I can offset the cost of my own office with the other space. And then we have other tenants that are in the back too. So it's like a whole kind of family style building.
That's awesome.
Had we not gotten that grant, I mean, it was like you invest a whole bunch of money up front and you get 3/4 of it back. So it was an expense, and you know, it meant that we couldn't pay off some other things, you know, as soon as we wanted to, but it definitely was like, and it was weird. Cause I'd always had that kind of dream in the back of my head that like, wouldn't it be awesome someday if that happened? And then I had moved all my stuff down into this office and I sat down on the couch and I looked up at the ceiling and I was like, oh my God,
I did it.
Like snuck up on me that like I had manifested this dream and then like, here it is. And you know, I could not be doing this the way I'm doing it now were it not for my husband making those sacrifices. And he is really awesome. And I am super appreciative that he is willing to do that, but it definitely has been like friction between us that I get to do what I love every day and he doesn't. And that's hard. It is hard to navigate that.
I think in our dynamic, encouraging each other to, Zoe, take your song and dance show downstairs, would you? Thanks. Encouraging each other to quit the K-12 game was the biggest thing. Just like, no, if you want to give up that security, I'm okay with that. And so I get to do that first. And then I encouraged him to do that. And like, we're both so much more relaxed and we both have the capacity to make more money now if we choose to. And things aren't like, we're not wealthy. We just keep working hard and putting that money into the long term.
What does he do now?
So my husband he has a really cool job. He works for one of the only state certified, distillation labs. So he works as a distributor. He goes to cannabis farms and collects cannabis flower. He brings it legally to his lab. Everything is tracked by the state. They process that into a value-added product. And if it's your brand, they'll brand it for you. If it's your product, they'll brand it for you. But they also grow their own, so they brand their own. And then he distributes those value-added products to a network of, we don't call them dispensaries here.
No.
They're called caregiver stores because Maine, legally, you can have a caregiver for your cannabis medicine. So basically you get your cannabis card here and then you go to most people would call them a dispensary, but we also just call them weed stores. So he's the man that knows all the farmers, knows the company that will take your flowers and turn it into something else that you don't have to smoke, and then distributes that product across the state.
That's so cool.
He has multiple sclerosis. So he's been a user for since he's been diagnosed. And so now that cannabis is not a big deal in Maine, he's been able to emerge from this public school teacher image to become one of like a champion of like, you don't have to take opiates for your pain.
Yeah.
I couldn't be prouder.
That's awesome. You know?
He's amazing and he works really hard. Yeah, I think he'll eventually have his own thing. But he's a man that loves to be on a team. You know?
Yeah.
That's part of his, what gets him going is when the team says, we're going to do this together. We did it together. What a great team. You know, he's like, yeah, rah, rah, team. Meanwhile, I'm up on the mountain going, I hate everybody. You know, because locally, when you're in a system like we were in, unless all the voters come to the voting and vote some things into power, you don't have an individual voice.
Yeah.
And now I do. And I feel so much lighter.
Yeah. Hey, you, Munchkin. Can you please take those guys and put them to nap or something? Because they are waking up my meeting. Well, can you play with them someplace else? Maybe your bedroom with the fan?
No, I
want to play. Can you be more quiet? Thanks.
Oh my goodness, if I tried to tell my kids to be more quiet, they would just be like 75 times louder. Oh, they're very, I'm like kind of dreading the you're not the boss of me phase of their lives. It's coming soon already. So one thing that I do at the end of all the podcasts is I ask all the guests the same 5 questions.
Okay.
And I love hearing all the different answers that people come up with. So the first one is, tell me about an experience that you had that shaped who you are today. Like one of those, it was one moment, and after that one moment, you're like, wow, life is totally different now.
I would say for me, that first time that happened, I was an exchange student. I was like wicked young. I was 15. It was Hurricane Andrew in Florida, so we were supposed to be in Florida, but then they're like, we're just gonna, hey, go get another peach from Mama. We were supposed to stay in Florida for like orientation, but they said, we're gonna just ship you right down to Venezuela. And it's gonna be a rapid process, and we don't usually process you this quickly. But anyway, here we go. We can't stay in Florida because it's, you know, the hotel is full of hurricane refugees. Okay, fine. So we get in another plane and then we get on a bus and we get on another bus. And, you know, it's like a long ass day for a 15-year-old kid from the sticks. So we finally roll into this conference center in the mountains of Caracas. Like, we get off the bus, they open the door, and there's like 300 people in the room from all over the world, of every color, speaking every language. And they let out a cheer and they said, we have been waiting for you to complete our group. The Americans came, the Americans are here. And it was like the United Nations party time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, whoa, I just went from a town of like literally 50 people on the Canadian border.
Mm-hmm.
Where everyone is either white or, you know, Passamaquoddy, indigenous to this land. And now I am here, and it's like a worldwide dance party with a bunch of kids my age that are different from me. And that was my, like, I did it. Like, you're in your basement going, I did it. I was like, I got out, you know, this is it. And that just really, you know, you talk about neural pathways being opened.
Mm-hmm.
My developing brain, that was a neural pathway that I was like, yes, I'm going to go down this rabbit hole for the rest of my life because I am now a global citizen. Mm-hmm. I have been invited to this party, and even though we were the last to arrive, here we are, and they've been waiting for us. So I love that because it didn't place, like, no offense to the United States, but we are not the greatest country on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And walking into a room where people were glad we were there, but we were not the best people there, right? It was just like, that's right. We're all in this equal game. And that affected my worldview for life. So long answer to the short question.
Okay, so number two, when you feel defeated or overcome, what do you tell yourself to keep going?
You know, mostly when I'm in that space, I have to go outside. So I tell myself, go outside.
It always works, doesn't it?
It does. And it takes me a long time to be like, just go outside. But then I do feel better.
Me too. Even if it's just for like 2 minutes, it's just like, oh yeah, there's more than this.
Yes.
A lot more than this. Tell me about a way that you overcame a failure or a mistake and what you learned from it.
One of the biggest regrets of my life is that I'm mouthy. I'm very mouthy. I'm a mouthy person.
Same.
I use that in a way that has hurt people.
I got better at the Cogalisco.
I applaud the girl who told me to my face, you're being a bitch and I don't like your behavior. And I said, tell me what about me don't you like? And she broke it down. I had never heard it put that way. That changed the course of how I treated other people. Sometimes you just gotta take it. And I had been giving it for so long, I needed to take it, and I took it. So that's, sometimes you just gotta take it.
I definitely had a similar experience too, where somebody like called me out on my bullshit, and they were publicly in front of a lot of people. And I was like so embarrassed that like my ears were ringing and everything looked orange. And I was like, oh my God, I'm like literally going to die from embarrassment right now. But it really totally changed the way that I present myself to other people. And that I'm just like, if you're not going to be true about who you are to other people, like why even bother being? So
it would be like, if you're going to be mouthy, make sure you're willing to take the lumps that come with it.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you're using it for the shot you want to take. Don't take the cheap shots anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's what I've done. I'm really picky with when I come out with it. Mm-hmm. And I do offend so many people when I do. And I'm able to say, I picked this shot for a reason. And here they are. As opposed to, you're right, that is really petty.
Yeah.
So I think it's really hard when you have a lot to say and are very opinionated and you want people to hear you, but maybe your motives aren't what they should be.
Yeah. Yeah, like let them mull around in your brain for a little while and make sure that it's like the right way and the right place and the right time to let that animal out of the cage, kind of.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. It's like the number one reason that I play music in my band. And that, like, that's my outlet. Cause I was like, you know,
yeah,
we can unleash the beast together and have like this unified front as like, this is our message that we're putting out there. And you know, it's not just me and we're sharing it out to people who are going to learn from it or who already are on that side of the fence and are really appreciative that they're not the only ones who feel that way. So it's been great having that.
Yeah. And I mean, also, yeah, I mean, we could go into this topic for a long time. I've learned a lot from other people calling out my behavior. Takes a really strong person to do that.
Yeah, it does, for sure. Okay, so number four, what is one trait or habit that's most responsible for your success and keeping you on track?
Rainbow
Buffet! You're like, I tune out the noise, that's how I'm successful. No.
Literally, no, in college, I lived in a freshman dorm my senior year. And this girl was like, why don't you party? I'm like, well, first of all, I'm done. And second of all, I just don't even pay attention to you girls. Like, you're 19 and it's fun for you, but I'm busy painting, right? But yeah, you know, the best thing I could have done for my muscles artistically was when I was an exchange student, I made a commitment to write every single day. And I think when you're into something, you should do it every single day. And if you suck at it, who cares? So that's just it. If you really like it, show up for it every day. Practice. You'll never regret. You will never regret the time you put in showing up for something that makes you feel alive.
Oh, I love that. I want to like make a shirt that says that. You should make a shirt that says that. Put it on your website. And I'll buy it.
My website's going to have a shirt that says Oxfo Comofo. Because I'm from Oxford County.
I'm always thinking of so many things. I'm like, I could put that on a shirt. I could put that on a shirt. And then I never do.
I'm like, we need to put that on a t-shirt.
I know. I keep coming up with all these quotes. And I'm like, that's too long to put on a shirt. It's always too long for a shirt. I'm like, I need like a 3-word phrase. I don't have those. Okay. So number 5, what's the best piece of advice you've ever gotten? And what advice would you give to other people?
So when I was going through my crisis of conscience about whether I should work for a system that I believe was broken during the Kavanaugh hearings, I went to my mentor. I was teaching gifted students. And I was in grad school for gifted education. And she had been the woman that I replaced. She's in her, whatever, 60s. So I called her crying. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like, this does not sit well with me.
Yeah.
She goes, do you care if you quit? Does it matter to you? Do you care? And I go, no. She goes, if you don't care, it doesn't matter. Boom, I didn't care. I could go and stand up for what I thought was right because the outcome, whatever it was, I was okay with. That's the best advice I've ever had. What was the second part of your question?
And what advice would you give to other people?
To go and read Paul Torrance's Manifesto for Gifted Children and apply it to yourself, whether you think you are gifted or not.
Ooh, I'm going to write that down. I re-listen to this.
His last name is Torrance, like the city in California.
Okay.
That's also like when I read that, I'm like, permission to break set. Okay, got it. But so many of us don't get that.
Yeah. I just love your whole energy, and you're just like, I'm going to do what I love and people are going to take it or people are going to leave it. And it's obvious from your Instagram that people are like, I'm going to take this all day because they just love that sunshine that you put out there. I mean, it's like, you know, obviously paper flowers are just so beautiful and they make people happy, but the way that you make it accessible for so many people and that you're, you know, willing to share content with people that doesn't necessarily bring money in your door and that you know, make it a point to put your beliefs and your politics like right up out there in your company. And there's a lot of companies that are, you know, before 2 weeks ago, we're really able to do that.
I'm a hardcore Christian. I'm the cussing, swearing, pot smoking Christian. And I am here to say that King Solomon told us a gift opens the way for a giver. Like, why are we not giving everything away? This is the message, right? Not take, 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 give, 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 right? And when you start giving away your gifts, well, what happens? Expansion. It's like that stupid candle lighting ceremony at graduation. It's like, oh, I have the light. Okay, you light your candle. Okay, now all the grads have their candle. It's like, no, that's so true. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to share what you've got. Why not? It's like a lonely little flame without it.
Oh, I love it. It's so
Oh, so yeah, I'm on this mountain. And this is my yeah, that's why I broadcast everything like I do, is because my community here is like down in town and they don't give a shit about what I do. They just want me to come to town meeting, pay my taxes and shop local. And I do all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. But because I'm so isolated, yeah, I have to use the network that I have. And Instagram is a great place for that. So I think that's how we found each other, is probably Instagram.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just being able to connect with people anywhere in the world at any time. And, you know, I know it sounds so hokey to be like, Instagram changed my life, but like Instagram really did change my life. I mean, I wouldn't have my papermaking studio had I not been trolling Instagram in the middle of the night, searching for hashtag papermaking and seeing what everybody else was doing.
So interestingly, before we close, I have endometriosis. I don't know if you knew that.
No, it sucks. I'm sorry.
I'm having a total hysterectomy in August. And so part of my creative drive, people are like, you do so much. I really use paper flowers as a distraction therapy for pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kept me from like going really deep into tech, because when I sit for a long time and I'm not distracted, everything hurts.
Yeah.
But it's one of those practices. It's like a twofer.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm done, I've got something pretty. And I spent 90 minutes not even thinking about whatever is happening.
Yeah, for sure. So
it's super powerful.
It really is. And I mean, obviously, global pandemic, I'm one of those people that I'm not necessarily like afraid of all sick people. Like, I'm not a crazy germaphobe, but I mean, no offense to any germaphobes out there, of course, because that is a real freaking thing. But I have like a serious, like real phobia of like puke and being around anybody who might be sick at any point. Like, my hands are sweating right now, like thinking about it.
Yeah.
And we started out our pandemic with our entire house having the stomach flu.
Oh no.
And like no one could come and help us because the world was shutting down and it wasn't safe for like my family to come help us. And like before we ever had kids, my husband, like, he knew the jam. Like, I was like, this is my phobia. It is not going away. Like, unless you want to spend like many thousands of dollars in therapy. Like, it's been my whole entire life like this. It is not a thing. Watch it in the movies, even in a cartoon. That shit is not funny. It's disgusting. And I am like, I just can't handle it. Like, I just run away. Like, I run away. I just do. And so I was like, if we're ever going to have kids, like, that part of it is all you. So having both the kids, like, one started to get better, and then the other one was like, but it kept being like, you know, middle of the night, like, Ralphing in the bed. And I was like, I can't handle this. I'm running away. Like, but there's nowhere to run away to because we couldn't leave the house because we were shut down. And so I like needed, once we started to feel better, but like I was like on the edge anxiety wise because the world was shutting down and like people I knew were sick, and then all of the other stress of my phobia on top of it. And like, I wasn't eating anything. I've already lost like 20 pounds in this pandemic.
We quit eating meat. I was like, I'm not gonna get stressed if I can't find a frigging pork chop, so I'm just gonna give up pork chops. My husband was like, good idea. And so we did have meat during pandemic, but like on Sundays we'd have bacon, or he'd pick up a couple of steaks.
Yeah.
Right. Once a week. And we both lost weight. We were like, oh my gosh, as horrible as the situation is worldwide, it's caused us to change our life.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing.
Yeah. It was weird. Cause like the first 10 pounds of it probably was like not intentional. And it was totally like losing weight because, well, having the flu and then being like insanely stressed out and not able to eat and not able to sleep. And for me, like, that is my number one stress response. As soon as I'm stressed, like, I am not eating. Like, that's just
right.
That's just how it goes. So being in my studio and my staff was all like working remotely, and then they got other jobs. And for most of the first like 2 months of the pandemic, it was just me working my ass off in my business to keep it open. Cause I was like, I have nobody. And people kept ordering things for me, which is amazing. But I was like, I have all this stuff to do, and like navigating all of like the federal loans and the grants and stuff like that. And I was doing all this, and my husband was laid off because they closed. So
he got out in the field in this time. Yeah.
And like, he was being like doing all the things that I had been doing. And I was like working 60 hours a week. Like, he had been doing. And I mean, I just ended up losing a lot of weight because I was just in my office for so many hours and there's not a ton of food down here. But I just noticed that like taking the time and like learning new flowers, because my assistant had been physically making most of the flowers that we've been doing and stuff like that. So getting myself into it and like taking your peony course and like actually like doing it myself. And the Festiva Maxima one.
Oh, you did.
And then the other one, the big, huge, giant one that you gave out for free.
Sunflower? Nice.
No, not the sunflower. The giant, huge peony that had like the... I can't remember. It was only up for like a couple days. You were like, do this and then share a picture of it.
Oh yeah, nice.
Yeah, so I did that one, and then I bought the one with the Festiva Maxima in it, that whole little package. And just doing those and like just making the flowers, it like helped me to just like, I didn't think about the world ending while I was doing that. And I was like, oh, this is so great. I could just keep doing this all day. I need to.
Yeah. And I love, that's my favorite part when I'm in it. Of all the facets of my business, when I am able to lose myself in the process is my favorite.
Yes. You know, and you don't think about how to do it, and you're not thinking about, you know, yesterday, and you're not thinking about tomorrow, and you're like, I'm very, you know, I think paper arts in general is very zen. It's very zen. And it's like, you know, if you force it, the paper gets ripped. And, you know, you can't, if you're trying to do it, it doesn't work. You just have to do it. And right. That's my favorite part about it. But, you know, paper making too, like if you're rushing any part of the process, I mean, you have to do this part until it's done, and you do this part until it's done, and you have to like learn patience and learn to like sit in that space where you're just waiting for the water to drip, and you're thing to wear, and you're waiting for the press to squish in, like you're just all of those things. It's like you just have to like be in it, and I just love that.
This one, I dyed this one after I made it, and I used so much water that it almost, like, it took several days to dry, and that whole patience thing, I'm like, every day I'm waking up like, is it ready? Is it done? Is it ready? Is it done? Can I dye with
it? Is it done? Like, hair dryer.
So, like, it's just the childlike part that we all should be tapping into on the regular. It's so important.
Exactly.
It's unbridled joy.
Aww. So, do you want to tell everybody where they can find you on the interwebs?
Sure. So my studio is called Flower and Jane. You can find it on flowerandjane.com. That's where all my courses are. There's an about section. I link to my work. My sculptural work is actually at a gallery on the coast of Maine. So I link to her page. It's called The Good Supply. And Catherine's amazing. She's a curator, and you call her and say, I need a present for a person who's like this. And she says, okay, I've got the perfect thing. And she will curate it from her gallery. And she represents just Maine artists. And she's amazing. I love her so much. And then where else can you find me? I'm on Instagram as Flower and Jane. My husband and I have a small flower farm as well, and that's, you can find us at Libby Ridge Looms. We only sell wholesale, so sorry to anyone who wants to buy our flowers, you have to have a minimum order to order with me, because I'm not going out to pick one flower. I want to go out and pick 100.
And you're like, I ain't driving down this mountain for nothing.
Exactly. That's, you hit it right on the nose.
Yeah.
Sometimes at work,
a lot of effort, you know. There's a lot of handling in addition to my shipping.
We actually, my husband, since he's a statewide distributor, he will deliver. And a lot of weed stores buy my flowers, which is great. I mean, if you're in there for flowers, why not buy flowers?
Exactly.
That's how I think.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being on my podcast and giving everyone a little glimpse into your world. And
privileged to talk to you. I've always admired you, and I loved when you came out with your other account where your spoken word poetry. I thought that was really not only brave, but beyond brave. It was like, yeah, you know, keep it up.
It's weird because before I was doing this, I mean, now in my life these days, since 2016, when I left my jobby job, most people in my community now know me as the Papercraft Miracles business owner person.
Yeah.
But prior to that, my whole entire life, I had been performing, and I have been out doing poetry for the community since I was 12 years old. So a really, really long time I've been performing for people. And then I became MC Vendetta in 2003. So, you know, 17 years of rapping as MC Vendetta. And like, it just, as far as like being, promoting that a lot, that was always like, I love playing with my band. We're called Bloodthirsty Vegans. And once I joined the band in 2008, so it's been quite a long time that we've been playing as a band. And for a while, like that, it's the same thing with the focus. You know, it's like, what is your focus on right now? And I'm like, I love performing and I love music, but as far as like marketing poetry and making yourself known and heard in the music world, it's really, really hard to like make money as a poet. And I knew that, like, as a student in college, which is partly why I wanted to come up with a way to make money off art. And so that I could support.
Do you have an MFA?
I don't. I ended up never going to get a master's degree.
I feel like you should be teaching at that level, because I just feel like so many artists at the BA level, or, you know, the BFA level, and I'm sure they have it now because we're whatever in our where we are. But we need more people who practice in the field to like teach in the field.
It was funny because I talked to my book arts teacher, my guru, Gwen Dean. She's just so amazing. And I was in my senior year of college and I was like, obviously I love book arts. Like, this is my jam. I want to be able to do this. And I said to her, I was like, what's the best school in the country to get a master's in book arts? And she's like, the Iowa Center for the Book, but don't go. And I was like, why not? And she goes, because there's like 3 jobs in the country and everyone who has them is going to work them until they die. And she's like, you already know what you want to do. You don't need a master's degree to do that. You don't need to.
Right.
She's like,
for you.
She's like, you want to have your own business and you want to do that. And if any of the skills, if you want to add to your book skills, you can go do like a 1-week residency at places and learn those other skills and take those things on and learn things online and, you know, like kind of be a student of the world instead. And she's like, the only thing you won't be able to do is like, you know, teach full time. But I was like, I don't really want to teach full time anyway. Cause I like teaching people, but it takes a lot of my energy to be in a room full of people who are soaking my energy up like that. And like,
I need a full day recovery.
Yeah. Like if I'm going to be, I'm obviously a totally extroverted, like hammy kind of person, you know, like I like the spotlight. I love that aspect to my life. But if I'm going to be giving my energy to a whole room full of people, I want to be up on the stage performing instead of educating. Like I want my performance to be the education, if that makes sense.
That makes sense.
So like in a perfect world for me, like give me a TED talk every day. Like I want to do that. That's on my bucket list. Like I want to be on that stage, like making everyone in the room have all their hair standing up because they're like, oh my God, we're all on the same wavelength at the same time. Like I am in this, I'm feeling this, I'm learning from this, and I'm going to take it and not be the same person after today. Like that's my jam, you know, like the power of like one moment to really, really fundamentally change somebody's life forever. Like I live there. I live in that zone. And that's why.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. Yeah. So one of my friends from my undergrad went straight to Iowa. She didn't do the Center of the Book. She has 2 degrees, but I forget what they are. Anyway, she doesn't practice. She has an MFA. She has 2 MFAs. I don't know. Regardless, she does not do what she went to school for. And she actually viscerally hates it.
Yeah. So. It's a tough thing. Cause I mean, I didn't get a master's degree. So obviously I can't teach on the college level, but I can always come and like be a guest speaker and probably make more for that one class than the teacher does. Because you're just showing up once. You don't have to do grades. You don't have to do any of that background crap. And you just get to like share your expertise and get paid for it, which I appreciate. But my husband and I are also like 2 of the only people that we know in our generation who have no student loans. It's like, we paid them off. And like, I don't know anybody else who's paid off their student loans, like 0 people. You know,
it took me 2 years, but I did it. My master's degree was paid for by my school district.
Yeah. His was paid for. He went to UCSD and got his fine arts master's in painting. And he got a full ride to go there, and he was a TA. So he actually made money. He took 1 student loan to buy a truck, which you can't do anymore. And he bought a car with it. And he paid off. That was his 1 student loan. And I had a ton of scholarships and grants when I went away to school, which is why it ended up being cheaper for me to move to North Carolina and live on campus and go to this private school than to stay home and go to University of Buffalo and take the bus every day. and like live in my house. It was cheaper to move across the country to go to school. So I only had like $8,000 in loans when I graduated. And, you know, when I graduated, the first job, full-time job I got, I made $6 an hour at a gas station. And I worked there for 5 years. And like, I chipped away at my loans and I chipped away at my loans. And I paid them off before I was 30 years old. But most, I mean, my husband and I are, and you too, are both in that, like, he's turning 41 in a couple of days. So like, we're both kind of in that like 5 year span between like 77 and 83, you know what I mean? Like right in there, some people in that range have managed to not take insane amounts of loans, but like anybody who's born like after 83, like the price of school just went up and the availability of scholarships and grants just like tanked. And there's just not.
Go ahead. We'll edit that part out.
Yes, we'll edit that part out. But yeah, there's just, it's weird because it's totally between like that zenial generation, like those couple of years, and then millennials. And millennials, it's like the world is just different for anybody born after like 1983, 84.
So I was born in 77, but so my town where I grew up in, I don't live in my town. I'm about 4.5 hours away. We didn't have our own school, so we were tuitioned, meaning we got to choose. Mm-hmm. Where we went to school, the bus was coming from one direction, but we could choose, like, if you're going to drive 30 miles regardless, like, you got to choose where you went. Mm-hmm. So when I became an exchange student, my town paid for it. Why? Because we got to choose, right? And it was cheaper for me to move to South America than for them to bus me to the local school. It was $200 cheaper. It was voted in without contest. So my town wrote the check that year for my exchange year.
That's so awesome.
It's insane. It's insane that it was cheaper to be an exchange student than to be bused 22 miles away or whatever it was. So, but yeah, I, as a Maine teacher, I'm always like, wait, are you a tuition town? Because have I got a deal for you? Because there's so many towns like that. And they just don't know until you tell them. So,
yeah. And New York is so different. I mean, it's just very lots of red tape, lots of bureaucracy. We pay lots in taxes, but we get lots out of it. I mean, I'm definitely not one of those New Yorkers that's like complaining about the taxes, because we have all sorts of services because of them. And I think that's great.
Right.
I'm happy to pay for services that help other people. You know, like that's part of why I'm glad.
My townspeople were like, you're saving us $200. Go for it. It's like, yeah, no, it's all about money.
Exactly. It is funny because I did a very short exchange student thing. Oh my God, she's so cute. When I was in eighth grade, I went to Costa Rica for 2 weeks and got to like go to school there with the kids and live with the family there. And yes. I ended up paying for it myself by selling t-shirts door to door. And like, I was always that kid that was like rocking out the school fundraisers. And like, it was just obvious as a kid that I was like, had this kind of entrepreneurial spirit that I was like, I'm going to work hard and I can get people to give me money for things. Like, I remember I had a garage sale. I brought all of my clothes outside while my mom was taking a nap, and I hung all my clothes on the bushes and put, I was like, I don't know, 7 or 8 maybe. And I made my own little price tags and like priced all of my clothing and try. And I was like, why aren't people buying my clothes? Like, well, how come? And I was like, I knew that my mom was broke and I was like trying to find any way I could to like make money for her. And she comes out and she's like, what are you doing out here? And I was like, I'm just trying to like pay the gas for my mom. You know, I'm like, I got skills. We can do this. And like, I'm the only, my dad's two brothers are entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
But other than that, like, I'm the only person in my insane family. Like, I had 7 brothers and sisters, and I'm an only child, and like 5 parents, and all of my aunts and uncles and whatnot. And like, out of all of those people, I'm just my 2 uncles. But other than that, I'm the only like entrepreneurial person in my family. And, you know, I remember telling my parents when I went to college, I was like, I want to be an artist and I don't want to be broke. That's what I'm majoring in. And my dad was like, really?
That's like, right. That's so important. It is so important. My first business was called Amity's, after my name, and I sold tie-dye t-shirts and I destroyed our bathtub, and I was 11. But it was the same concept, like, I can make something and people will buy it. That is amazing.
Yeah, that's like both my parents, I would say my mom and my legal dad, both of my main parents, they were never actually together during any part of my life. But they both had like creative things that they loved to do. My mom was a poet. She was also a paper artist, and she would do like these amazing rubber stamp collages and like little gucco screen prints and stuff like that. Post fancy postcards and collage work and stuff like that. And she liked doing music and theater. She was just kind of like a jack of all trades as well. But I don't even think she ever made like a single dollar on like any of the art that she did, because she just like didn't have that business aspect to her brain. And she was all just like, I'm doing this because this is what I have to do. I love this and I'm going to put it out there. And my dad was a photographer when I was a kid, and he would take pictures of everything like all day long, but he worked as like the lackey in somebody else's dark room, like developing like product photos. And this is like in the 80s, and he was making like super crappy money and like couldn't do anything to make money doing something creative. And he ended up going back to school to be a physics teacher. And he was a physics teacher in college until he just retired a couple years ago. And so knowing that growing up where both of my parents obviously had these creative outlets, and my other dad loved to play music, still plays music, and he's almost 80. But that's none of them had anything creative as their job in any way. And having most of my parents come home every day and be like, oh, I was done with work. Oh, you know, just that going to work was such a shitty thing. And that it was such a huge part of their lives. I was like, I don't care what I need to do, but I need to not have that be my adult life. Like, and
the big thing was, I didn't want to be broke. My parents were living their dream as an organic farm, which is great, but you don't make money farming.
Yeah.
And so my sister did it. She decided to become a corporate lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Now she runs her own goat empire. She said, fuck being a lawyer.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to do what I need to do. And that's because we grew up on a farm. She has a goat farm. And now I have a flower farm. Right. So, but I have this base business that pays me, that was my thing. I wanted to make sure I always had money for what I felt like I wanted at the time.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you some lunchy. How about some lunch? Oh, it's 11:11. It's time to make the noodles.
Yes. Aw. Well, anyway, I could talk to you all day long, but I know that you have all day long, and I don't have all day long. I've got other things I need to be doing on my schedule. But thank you so much for this wonderful conversation and for starting my day like this. This is great.
And let me know when it airs and if I can do anything else to help.
Yeah, I definitely will. Awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening, everybody. You can check us out on all of the places where podcasts happen, on Spotify and iTunes and whatnot. And there will be all sorts of info in the show notes. And thank you so much to my wonderful guest, Amity Catherine Libby of Flower and Jade. Awesome. Have a good day, everybody.
A single interaction has the power to change your life forever. This is a place for the stories of those moments. Stories of pursuing dreams, overcoming tragedy and failure, of coming back to life after so much of what feels like dying, of continuing on with only a vision as a map. This is the place where those moments live on. Come sit by the fire, look up at the stars, and be forever changed too.
Thank you for being with us on the Reach the Stars podcast. Our theme music is generously provided by Byrocratic. You can find him on bandcamp.com. Thank you to all of our current patrons, guests, and everyone else who helps make this dream a reality. We are so proud to be building this amazing community with all of you. If you love this podcast, please consider sharing with a friend, leaving a review on iTunes, and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/reachthestars. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel to see the videos of these conversations. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, do something cool and tell us about it.